Okay, I have the pleasure today to tell you about CHIME, which is a funded near-term experiment to measure 21 centimeter intensity and go off the baryon acoustic oscillation peaks. So that's the job I've been given by the organizers. The job that's been given to me by my collaborators is to excite you about this science and convince you as well that there's a whole lot of work to be going on theoretically in terms of biases and nonlinearities and so forth, that much like the work that was discussed earlier this morning. So there's a lot to do out there. And then also in terms of cross correlations and analysis techniques. So hopefully that will be one of the things you take away here, and you'll join into the effort and the fun that we're having. So as Eric pointed out, the signal that we're going after is exactly the same signal that I've been used to measuring with the cosmic microwave background, the baryon acoustic oscillations, propagated forward to a much more recent redshift. For the case of CHIME, we're interested in the redshift regime, essentially where the optical surveys to date have petered out. We're starting at redshift 0.8 and taking that out beyond the point where dark energy began to turn on. So we're taking that out to a redshift of 2.5 or so. This is a very different 21 centimeter intensity mapping than what's going on at to try to detect the reionization signal. Okay. And the slide that, or a similar slide to what Eric showed before, there's several ways to get at this. You can go out and measure individual galaxies with a resolution that far exceeds the scale at which the physics is of interest, or you can blur that out by doing intensity mapping and measure the net hydrogen signal from a collection of galaxies from the gas that's out there. So the scales that we're after are, of course, much larger. The current state of the art that Daniel showed yesterday in terms of Sloan, Boss, Wiggles E, and so forth ends at about 0.6. And of course, that same signal we pick up again at a redshift of 1100 with the CMB experiments. And it's this key a redshift in here that we'd like to fill in with an experiment like CHIME. It's a volume-limited survey. The types of error bars you expect to get back from CHIME once it's completed. I'm going to jump to the end of the talk and show the conclusions. The type of error bars that you'd expect to bring back from CHIME are shown here. And really what we're doing is at small redshifts, you're limited by the amount of universe that's out there. Your error bars are volume limited because you just don't have a lot to look at. And at higher and higher redshifts, there's a whole lot of universe and you can make a really good precise measure of the baryon acoustic oscillations there. In K-space, if you take the signal that we're measuring and instead of showing it in the usual real space, you can see the multiple peaks of the baryon acoustic oscillations. At large scales out here, we're limited by sky area and the amount of universe that's out there. And at small scales, we're limited by our instrument noise and our instrument's angular resolution. So in this plot, I've shown the error bars for full CHIME, integrating across all redshifts for one particular cosmology and reconstructing the baryon acoustic oscillation peaks. Okay, so the universe as we know it and the cosmological probes we have today, we start close to us with experiments like Sloan and Wiggles E and learn about the expansion history of the universe. We can step out quite a bit further, for example, with experiments that go after galaxy clusters like ACT and the South Pole Telescope and learn about the growth of structure at these same redshifts that CHIME's going after, and then ultimately learn about the surface of last scattering as well. Once CHIME has completed its survey, it will have mapped the largest volume of the universe to date with a single astronomical instrument, about 100 gigaparsecs per age. Beyond that, though, it's also a pathfinder and a means of honing our analysis strategies, our instrument techniques, and our theory to go after much larger volumes and go after the reionization signal and indeed all of the dark ages. So for me, I'm very excited about this experiment, not just because of the near-term science, but also because of the technology and the reach that it may ultimately have to bring us back new information about the universe in which we live. Now, the difference between doing 21 centimeter intensity mapping at redshift 2 and doing it at redshift 10 may not be immediately apparent. Okay, the signal itself is about 100 microkelvin at redshift 2 where CHIME is, and it's about 100 times larger or so out at the redshifts of reionization. the foreground scale in about the same way. The synchrotron emission is scales by about that same factor. So it might look like these types of experiments are equally hard. That's kind of true. It's different wavelengths. So of course, the electronics that we build, the digitizers that we build, have to operate at a much faster speed and handle faster data rates. But most important here, the signal is very, very different. The signal at redshift 2 has a Fourier space fingerprint that I know almost exactly what it looks like. So when I go out to design Chime, or when other people go out to design the competitors, we know exactly what the signal that we're going after looks like. And that gives us an advantage in designing the experiment itself. We know what the signal looks like. We have a pretty good idea of what the foregrounds look like at this depth. And so we can really tune our experiment in to go after that signature. As Eric pointed out, Chime is not the only experiment that's been proposed to go after the signal. There's of course, the experiments that are going on right now with Green Bank and the GMRT and the beautiful results that Eric just reported on, which for now stand to make detections of the power spectrum itself. In the future, there's Chime, which is a set of drift scanning cylinders. There's DAOBAB, which is essentially a scaled version of paper, which has been proposed and I believe is just coming out of review now. There's also a UK effort led out of Manchester called Bingo, which is a multi-feed single dish experiment, which is still in its design phases. Let me show you how a cylinder experiment like Chime works. Let me take a snowboard half pipe and build it out of metal and place just a single feed in the middle. I'm going to choose to orient this dish north to south. And this is a dish in one dimension. So you're used to telescope dishes that are round, okay, and they focus up light in 2D. This focuses up light in one dimension. I'm going to orient this cylinder north to south, and it's going to serve to take the night sky with my omnidirectional feed and focus it up east to west, so that now I'm looking at a stripe directly overhead. Okay? If I then take this half pipe and pepper it with a bunch of feeds, in the case of Chime, it'll have 256 feeds down this feed line. And I could signals from all of these feeds, make the wire lengths just right so that they add coherently in one direction. I would have a one feed telescope that's focused east to west by the dish and north to south by the correlator or the delays in the cables that are operating here. What I just described with cable delays is how older style cylinders used to work. Today, we have the power to digitize all of these feeds separately and process them in a very big computer and form beams in any direction, and of course, simultaneously form beams in all directions. So now what I have is a dish that focuses up light east to west in the old style, and then a digital telescope that forms beams north to south. I can then wait for the Earth to turn, and that'll take my telescope and spin it around, and I eventually, every 24 hours, map the whole overhead sky. For the case of Chime, we have a slightly more ambitious collection of cylinders. There's five cylinders, each with a width of 20 meters and a length of 100 meters, so that the total collecting area is 100 meters by 100 meters, similar to Green Bank. And it's peppered with 1,280 dual polarization feeds. What that means is that we take that stripe from north to south that we had from that one feed in one cylinder, and we divide it up into 1,280 different beam elements. Each one of these feeds has the same system temperature as, let's say, the Green Bank receiver, then each one of these little circles that I've drawn in cartoons here, in cartoon land here, has the same footprint on the sky as one Green Bank feed and the same noise properties. Okay, so what I end up with is an instrument that in one beam is no more sensitive than anything else. In fact, it's gonna end up being a little bit less sensitive because we don't have a cryogenically cooled feed. But we have 1,000 of these beams on the sky, so we've built a really hot survey machine. And that's the name of the game here. We can scan the sky really quickly. Yes, go ahead. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. If I had that kind of money and that kind of computer, that's what I'd build, and that may be what I build next, or that may be what I build at longer wavelengths, for sure. Yeah, so the question here, Alex didn't have a microphone, is couldn't you do this in two dimensions with just a field of antennas? And of course, yes, you can do exactly that. And it becomes exactly that, a fast Fourier transform telescope in two dimensions. An artist impression of this from the Canadian press, of course, they like to measure everything in hockey rinks. So Chaim is 6 hockey rinks big. I have a strong preference about who's playing on those hockey rinks, but I won't bore you with that. And the cylinder is located on planet Earth in Penticton, BC. Okay, so a latitude of 47 degrees, and it looks out at the night sky and collects light, and then as the Earth rotates, it eventually brings back this three-dimensional map of the universe. You may not be familiar with them, but there's cylinders all over planet Earth looking up at the night sky right now, and there's a bunch of them shown here. Most of them look nothing like Chaim and could not be used for anything like Chaim. Most of them are articulated cylinders that can track across the sky. They're built by stringing wires down long lengths, so they're sensitive to just one polarization. The other polarization goes straight through and is not reflected. And they typically have fairly narrow bandwidths. Okay, so they're typically geared up for solar physics and things other than cosmology. The cylinder that looks most like Chaim is actually one of the first cylindrical telescopes, which was built just outside of Chicago. It has about the same collecting area. It was built in the late 50s, and it also had cosmological goals to sort out the differences between various types of galaxies. It had a narrow bandwidth, and it wasn't the type of telescope that gained favor because it didn't have a cryogenically cooled receiver. So at this time, you could put many feeds down a feed line, and the noise of each one of these feeds was quite high. And so this lost out against telescopes that had a single feed or a couple of feeds, but you had the resources and the money to spend time cooling those feeds and making them very sensitive. Today, because of the technology we have in our pockets for our cell phones or up on the mountaintops for cell phone repeaters, it's in everyone's interest to build very low noise amplifiers. And I can go out and buy an amplifier that across the bandwidth that I'm interested in has a noise equivalent temperature of around 30 to 40 Kelvin. So it's that technology that makes it possible for us to have so many different receivers without cryogenically cooling them and still get a fairly good measure on the sky. I basically already covered this, which is how noise spreads out in the sky and how essentially with many different feeds across the same area as something like the Green Bank Telescope, we end up with the same sensitivity per beam, but many more beams. Okay, so now let me introduce the Chaim experiment to you. Chaim is a collaboration of 4 different institutions, all based in Canada. Dick Bond and Chris Sigurdsson are here, and are 2 of our members from Toronto. There's also Whaley Penn and Keith Vanderlinde at Toronto. Over at UBC, there's Mark Halpern and Gary Hinshaw as well. And at McGill, there's myself and David Hanna, and at HIA, Tom Landecker. And then a number of postdocs and graduate students as well. So Chaim is a transit telescope. It has no moving parts. I will never have to go out in the cold and grease a telescope again, which, having spent most of my time in the South Pole Telescope, is a good thing. It has one scan strategy. The sky is going to rotate overhead, and that's what we're stuck with. We don't get to spend time simulating different ways to look at the sky. It looks at the sky 24/7, and there's no time allocation committee or anything else to decide what we look at and how we look at it. So these are good things. Eventually, we do plan to make the 3D cube map of the universe public. One thing about this, though, is there's many other signals that are on the sky, things that are changing in time, like radio transients and pulsars, that if we go through just our standard cosmology scan strategy, where we're going to end up integrating down over long time periods, we might erase that signature. So that's some of the other things that people should be thinking about now, what else Chaim can be used for. In terms of the specifications, I have this in the talk mainly as an archive for people who might be looking at it online. Our bandwidth, stretching from 8 gigahertz at redshift 0.8 for the 21 centimeters, 400 megahertz at redshift 2.5. Our beam varies in size from about a quarter degree at the shortest wavelength out to about a half a degree at the longest wavelength. Unfortunately, that's exactly the wrong way that you wish it evolved with redshift when you're building an experiment. Okay, let me show you how data flows through Chaim. We start with our 5 cylinders in the upper left, and there's 512 different digitizers that stretch down the cylinders, recording 2 polarizations of 256 different feeds. There's a low noise amplifier right on the cylinder Then the signal is brought either through a cable or a fiber to a digitizer, which sits inside a counting room. And then it goes into a set of field programmable gate arrays, which channelize the data. So we take our experiment that stretches from 400 to 800 megahertz, and we divide it up into several hundred little experiments with a little bit of bandwidth, from 400 megahertz to 401 megahertz, for example. At that point, we have a giant networking problem in that we need to get all the information from all the different feeds in one particular band into the same computer down here, a cluster of graphics processor units, and form beams on the sky. So there's a giant network that sits between these channelizers and the end output. To take this technology and stretch it out in 1D, where we start at the cylinder itself in the feed, we go through our low noise amplifiers, filters, cables, and so forth, I'm going to use this diagram. And just because we've been talking about Chime now for a year or two in terms of what we're going to build and what will be built, it's very fun now today after a year or two of effort to show what has been built so far and just show you how real this project is and how near term it is until we actually have data on this guy. These are our four square feeds. They essentially act like two cross dipoles. In this case, we're using them in a fairly novel arrangement where all four petals are contributing to the polarization signal in each of the two polarizations. So it's feeds like these that will be recording the electromagnetic signals. That then goes into a low noise amplifier box, which amplifies the signal. This has a noise equivalent temperature around 35 Kelvin. Once you attach it to the feed and take the losses of the feed, it ends up being across our band about 50 Kelvin, which is our goal across the entire band. From there, it either goes into a set of coax cables or an RF over fiber system, which takes these analog signals, converts them to modulated light, and then sends them through a long optical fiber to the digitizers. And it lands at a digitizer board at the far end, which samples this data at a fast rate and pipes that into a new set of FPGA boards, which we just finished last week and are being manufactured actually right. From there, it goes through a giant network. That network has a tremendous data rate. It's about a terabyte per second. That's about what Google was receiving and sending out two years ago. And so after passing through that network, arriving back at the FPGA boards, it's piped directly out one-to-one to a set of GPU processors that take this information and both do beamforming and separately do an N-squared correlation. Okay? The beamforming is where we'd like to be in the future. We have a straight 1D line of antennas. So our correlation, if we knew our calibration coefficients perfectly, is just a one-dimensional FFT along that beam line. And that's cheap. That's inexpensive. We don't need a big computer to do that. But that's really challenging because we need to demonstrate that we can know our gain coefficients, our complex gain coefficients, in real time. And while we think we can do that, we haven't demonstrated that yet. So we're hedging our bets and also building a full N-squared correlator that will record the full visibilities and allow us to apply those calibration coefficients afterwards. In terms of development and development timeline, since for the last couple years, we've had a two-dish a prototype out at the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory, which is shown in the upper right-hand corner. This is just a test bed for our electronics, our feeds, and antennas, and so forth. We broke ground about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, for the Chime Pathfinder. The Chime Pathfinder is a really exciting development. It is exactly the same as Chime, but it is one-third the width and one-third the length with the same diameter cylinders. Okay, so it's one-tenth the collecting area, and it has one-tenth the number of feeds on the sky. It stands to be able to make the first detection of the baryon acoustic oscillations at near redshift, okay, but it isn't an make that detection out at far redshifts at 2.5. We need full Chime for that. That should be on the sky by the end of this year, and we'll be prototyping our hardware on that by this summer. Full Chime is scheduled for first light sometime in 2016, and so that isn't terribly far away as well. Let me just show you a few photos that make the Chime Pathfinder real. The Pathfinder sits out here in this field, just on the far side of the road of the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory. And this is the groundbreaking in late January of this year. Just last week, the legs that support the truss structure of the cylinders for the Chime Pathfinder were arriving on site and beginning to be installed on the concrete piers that is the foundation for Chime. The DRAO has a really excellent RFI environment for the wavelengths that we're interested in. So there's two regimes that are partially obscured with RFI at about 700 megahertz and down at low frequency that essentially will be hard to record data in. But the total level of this RFI isn't such that it would make our amplifiers non-linear. And in fact, 700 megahertz peak has gone down quite a bit since people have switched to other cell phone technology. The big fear for the future, of course, is digital TV. Now, to move on a little bit to analysis strategies and to get back to Iris's question, there's a lot of talk today about the foreground wedge and how we go about taking away the foregrounds from this data. At first blush, if you have a perfect instrument, the problem shouldn't be that hard, right? The foregrounds are smooth along the line of sight. As your beam evolves, so as you move from one frequency to the next, your beam is expanding in angular space. So you're picking up more and more galaxies that are also emitting synchrotron radiation, and so that also pollutes your data queue. But if your instrument were perfect, those signals don't overlap essentially at all with the VAO signal. Unfortunately, our instruments are not perfect, and we have some ripple inside our passband. I can't build a passband for any analog amplifier or filter bank that doesn't have some ripple in it. So I have to have a way to contend with that. One of the strategies that has been, and the strategies that we deal with this are different depending on the instrument you build. So it's not just the case that you build something and you try all these and see what works best. You, of course, need to tune your instrument up from the start, knowing the analysis technique that you think is most likely to work. So one of the things that has received the most attention so far is the delay spectrum technique. Imagine that I have a source out on the sky. I'll put it over here, and it has a flat spectrum, or a near flat spectrum, or a smoothish spectrum. So its Fourier spectrum is shown in the upper right-hand corner. If I then record that with an interferometer that has a relatively small dish area compared to the dish separation, then there's a delay between what I see at the first dish and the second dish, and that results as I move across my frequency band in a point in frequency space where I have perfect destructive interference, then perfect constructive interference, and so forth. So essentially, I get a sine wave there, and that shows up if I take my correlated signal in the middle and then take the Fourier transform of that to get a delay spectrum, so I'm Fourier transforming it one more time, now after correlation, that shows up as a delta function. Cool, I know where my foregrounds are. Foreground, and I move it from the very horizon all the way to the other horizon, then there's a delta function can move back and forth between the maximum lag that I have here with my dashed lines. So it seems like the foregrounds are contained in one regime. And this is exactly what Eros was talking about earlier, in that what one thing you can do is just take that whole regime and throw it away. Most of your sensitivity is there, though. Your BAO signal is there, though. The thing you're trying to see on the sky is there. Right, so the nice thing is that your BAO signal, which has a ripple in frequency space, once it comes down through the correlation and then the Fourier transform again, it will populate all of this space and you still have signal on the outside. So you can stand, if you can really perfectly understand the passband of your instrument, you know your instrument perfectly, you can still stand to find a little region of space that is full of signal and not so full of foregrounds. This is not the technique that we plan to use in Chime. It throws away a lot of your sensitivity, and it relies on having dishes that are far separated and a perfect understanding of your passband. Another technique that can be used is basically evolved from what Eric showed earlier, and it involves sorting the modes of your signal in terms of M mode. So as the Earth turns, the modes that you're able to see overhead decompose exactly into a limited number of M modes, exactly like the spherical harmonic YLMs that we use to measure the CMB. Here we're binning in M's instead of L's. for all of the L's, and each point in the sky as it goes across, each Fourier ripple in the sky as it goes across, populates one of these M modes or another M mode. Okay, and so there's a limited amount of information that you need to bin your signal up in. And then by having some rough model of the foregrounds and some rough model of the signal, you can, so long as your instrument is stable in time, without knowing your passband structure at all, you can sort these K modes, knowing your signal model and your foreground model, and come up with those eigenmodes, which are very signal-like and very foreground-like. This is exactly the opposite problem of what I showed before. In the previous one, you need to know your passband perfectly. In this one, you don't need to know your passband at all, but you need to keep it stable in time. So it comes down to an issue of calibration instead. One of the other problems with the previous analysis technique as well is Faraday rotation. You can calibrate your instrument so that in one direction you perfectly know the relative gains of polarization X and polarization Y. But once you come off that axis over here and you beamform with it, you're no longer able to use that same calibration. Okay? With this technique, because you're using the information from multiple baselines to build up your knowledge of the signal, you get that extra information in, and you can handle the Faraday rotation. So in the upper right-hand corner, this is a paper by a postdoc at CETA, Richard Shaw, and a bunch of others, including Chris, who's in the back room here, and is here for the next couple of weeks, so a good person to talk to about this. We essentially sort out the M modes on the sky. We do a KL decomposition and find those that are most signal-like and most noise-like. And you can see we have a very different signature of our signal in the top and the synchrotron-like noise in the bottom. If we keep all of the modes, our synchrotron signal and cosmology signal essentially reports back nothing in angular space or in frequency space. As we apply a harder and harder cut on these modes, the signal starts to pop out and the foregrounds start to go away. And eventually we get back to a signal-like situation. Okay, beyond cosmology, there are many things that an experiment like, I'll be 30 more seconds, that an experiment like Chime can do. For example, we see the entire overhead sky each night. And so while it's a very challenging thing to take all of that data and search it across many dispersion measures for pulsars each night so that we search the whole sky every night, what we can do is pull off a few beams on the sky from our beamformer and monitor known pulsars. This is especially attractive for pulsars that are already being monitored by other instruments and pulsar timing arrays, because the effects of space weather, the ionosphere, and so forth are much larger in our band than in higher frequency bands. So we stand to provide a much better correction for those measurements. We can also do a pulsar search in the sense that we wouldn't want to search the whole sky every night. That's a very, very expensive computational challenge. But we can pull off a few beams each night, maybe 1/400th of the pixels on the sky. And then over the course of a year, we can search the entire night sky with a very uniform, very robust search for pulsars. There's all sorts of radio transient phenomena as well, including rats and so forth that stand to be discovered and monitored nightly as well. I'll skip the one example I have of that. Okay, so in summary, Chime is a new experiment to go after the 21 centimeter intensity mapping signal from redshift of 1 to 3. It is funded. It is being built now. It is an exciting new development for the BAO, and also as a pathfinder for other possible sciences, both at the same frequency instrument and at higher redshifts eventually. Once Chime comes online, full Chime in 2016, it should be able to bring back the largest volume map of the universe to date at low angular resolution to measure the effect of cosmic expansion. With this data set, there's a ton of work that can be done in terms of cross-correlations with, for example, CMB lensing, quasar surveys, and so forth. And so I really encourage people to think about those. And then a lot of theoretical work in terms of the signal itself that we can address. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for this very interesting talk. Questions now, please.
So what determines you have passband from 400 megahertz to 800?
400 megahertz from 400
to 800. So what was the limiting factor here? Why you can't go lower or higher?
So we stand to make a much better measurement of dark energy by going lower, but you've already done that. We'd like to overlap, and we're just barely overlapping there. It's challenging to go lower because of cell phones and the RFI environment at the DRO. So on the lower end, we're essentially bounded by that. Once you go up to a higher frequency, doing an octave is hard in terms of our antennas and sensitivity. Doing more than that is even harder. And then right outside of that 800 megahertz bandwidth, there's new signals that turn on as well. There's the 850 megahertz band for cell phones. So it becomes challenging. It's expensive and challenging to go beyond that. But nature is kind. The band that I would have chosen anyway is the band that's available.
Yes. So I have a quick, can you elaborate a little bit on the calibration strategy, actually how it works, and also on the data storage strategy? What do you keep, what do you throw away, and what can you do offline?
So there's two levels to the calibration strategy. Okay. The first level happens in the instrument only, and we really, once we've calibrated up the instrument on the sky, we need to monitor that calibration and ensure it doesn't change. So in an analogy to a regular single dish, a telescope with one pixel, you want to make sure that the light that arrives at the feed arrives there coherently. So you can't have your mirror flexing and deforming. If you build a mechanical structure, that's easy. You just build it really well and forget about it. If you have a digital telescope like this, that amounts to knowing the complex gain of every feed as a function of frequency and keeping that constant. So our big challenge here actually isn't knowing that calibration to start with, which is challenging enough, but making sure it doesn't change. So what we need in order to do that is to populate the information that's coming back from each feed with a known signal that is seen by all of the antennas. So for example, one of the things that we're working on right now is a calibration signal that's injected into each cylinder. It doesn't really matter that we hit the feeds in the same way. I'm not trying to do a relative calibration between feeds. I'm trying to figure out how that feed is changing as temperature varies and so forth. So if I can take one signal and split it into the five cylinders without changing it, and then have that seen above the noise with each of these feeds, I can record that complex gain and monitor it and adjust it as a function of time before I do my beamforming. Now, that signal needs to be white, so it needs to populate the whole band, and I don't want it to be noisy. It has to be above my noise, and it can't be noise. So it has to be a pseudo-random number that's essentially white in phase. Or it has to be something that chirps on and chirps off, and you would have to believe that we have no non-linearity whatsoever. It's across the full band, from 400 to 800 megahertz. It has to be. And in the case of a pseudo-random number, it can be on all the time. Right? Is it something that you can measure and subtract? And you can actually use this to improve your nonlinearity of your digitizers, because you can ensure that you exercise just the right bits or all of the bits, the average of them. This is a work in progress. I'm not standing up here saying, we've built this, we know it works, we're doing it. It's something we've built right now, and we're exercising it to try to show how it works. On the sky, we have pulsars. There's a ton of pulsars. There's several hundred pulsars that are flashing on and off at a hertz or so, and that are very bright for chime. So the nice thing about pulsars is that they turn on and off, and so we can get them on and the rest of the sky, and essentially difference these two things to have just one point source on the sky. So by using chime and correlating it with a separate dish, like the 26 meter that's already at the DRIO, we can do holography, have a very accurate measure of that pulsar with the 26 meter, refer that back to each of the feeds, and then do refer our calibration back onto the sky. Your second question was about data storage and data management. The data set here is huge, right? We start with a terabyte per second, and there's no hope to write that to any sort of disk. Not unless we're Google and we have all those different paint colors to paint our cylinders with. So we have to process and compress that data in real time. If we were able to make the beamforming fully work so that we calibrate in real time, and we just have the beams on the sky, the data set actually isn't very big at all, so long as we average out to reasonable timescales for cosmology. Each pixel of the sky spends about 10 minutes in our beam, so we can average to very, very long timescales. We could average down to a minute or so, and if we divide it up into beams on the sky, the total data set is small, terabytes. If, on the other hand, we do need to keep and maintain our full set of baselines, where we have n squared information, right? Our data in each frequency band is rolling off at about a microsecond. And so if we have 2,000-ish elements and it's n squared, so that means we have 2,000 times more data, right? Any sort of averaging down, if we average down to a second, we've only compressed our data by a factor of 1,000. If we average down to 30 seconds, you know, it's a factor of 30,000. It's not a big compression factor. And so that data set does become very large. It's of the order of a petabyte, and we're not able to store it separately for every night. So what we have to do is process, have the baselines for many nights, five nights, for example, check them for consistency, check that that each pixel falls within a Gaussian noise structure, and then co-add those over about 5 or 10 days and store that. I'm still storing the individual visibility, so I still get to apply my calibration miter. Okay? But my data set now is a very large data set, and that's challenging. It's not large compared to many other data sets, but we're small in dollars, in people, in resources, and so it becomes large for us.
So I think I had the polarization version of Olivia's question, which was, if I think of the calibration as, say, a 4x4 matrix for the intensity and the three Stokes parameters, can you, how would you know if, for example, the Q to I leakage term is time dependent, or monitor and calibrate that term?
Yeah, so I have to have multiple sources on the sky. Right. If I have just one source in the sky, so my pulsar example doesn't work. Right. In order to get more than two pieces of information from my two polarizations, I need multiple sources on the sky. So it's a much more complicated algorithm to get at that. And I mean, you can start to do it on the board and so forth. I don't think it's a good idea.
So you showed us a tiny errors on BAL thing, and then probably they are just statistical errors, right? And do you have any sense of what the level of systematic errors would be in that kind of figure?
Yeah, so most of the systematics that you look at here are going to affect the amplitude of that spectrum. So any physics you do with the amplitude is very, very hard. And the BAO scale itself is somewhat less
involved.
Yeah,
but you showed us the error bars on the including amplitude, right?
Yeah.
So what are they?
Those error bars are statistical only.
And do you have any idea about what how big the systematic errors would be compared to those errors?
I don't have a precise answer for you.
Yeah, any rough numbers would be comparable or factor of 10, smaller or
comparable larger. To within 20%.
So that's still very small.
Yeah.
So what makes you think that way? I mean, because nobody has seen this before, right? And nobody has convincingly detected any signaling autocorrelation. We don't even know what the errors are at the possible level.
I mean, obviously, I can't convince you 100% of this, you know, and nobody can, because nobody has ever measured the foreground at this depth.
Exactly.
It's unknown ground.
Right.
You know, the best we've done so far is Eric. I don't see where he's sitting.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, he's shown an upper limit,
right,
which says there could be stuff in the sky that's foregrounds that's residual, or it could be the signal itself. There's no one out there that actually has that measurement down to the level that we'd like to be at.
Right.
Now, there's other things, for example, that we do know about. For example, Faraday rotation in the universe and how that contaminates our signal. That's not an unknown question about astrophysics in the universe. That's an unknown question about how our instrument behaves. Right? And that's something I can study and model and set specifications on the instrument itself. But anything to do with foregrounds, right? If you come up with a foreground model that, first of all, I can't get rid of, or that I can get rid of, but somehow it smears my peaks. You know, I've screwed up there in my analysis, or the foregrounds are brighter or more rich.
Okay, I'm not actually worried about peak positions, which are probably very robust, but really the absolute measurements that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
People that we don't really know what
the next time that I'm able to answer this question better than this will be when the Pathfinder has a year of science in.
Mm-hmm.
We will be the first ones to really go down this deep and say something about it.
Are there more questions? If not, the very last one.
On the Pathfinder, if everything goes well, you said it could detect BA already, right?
The Pathfinder with 1 year of observations can detect the BAO, you know,
at what?
Statistically at a redshift of 0.8. We're smaller, right? The bigger BAO are easier, are the only thing that we can essentially get.
Mm-hmm. I'm detecting mean 5 sigma or more?
I think I don't remember, it's 5-ish sigma. It was somewhere between 4 and 6. It depended who was running things and so forth. Yeah. Okay. So hopefully it'll be enough to convince you that full time is on the right track. You aren't going to do any better with dark energy on that, right? It's not better than others.
Okay, then I think we close the question session here, and we thank our speaker again for this very interesting talk. And now I wish to welcome Lloyd Knox as a short-term, fill-in, so to speak, for our originally first speaker of this session.